chance of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. Welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, interfaith relations, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church. Today we are celebrating a very special anniversary. This is our 500th broadcast of Muffin Talk. 500 interviews. And so for this broadcast, I've put together some snippets that show the variety of these interviews. It all started with the welcome words of the late Joan Lardner Rivlin.
I'm delighted to welcome Beatty to our family of Planet FM.
Bosco was an amazing saint. Yeah, I felt that he was chosen by God to reach out to the poor and abandoned boys who had come in search of jobs in the city. Don Bosco realized that they were victims of the circumstances of his time. The Industrial Revolution had driven many of these boys to the cities in search of jobs. But with a lack of proper home and care, they were helpless. And hence Don Bosco took it upon himself to care for these poor and neglected boys. And he saw St. Francis de Sales as a person who would be the best example.
The problem about nightmares is that they are dreams. They wake you at a point of horror or terror when you feel helpless to know how you can prevent something dreadful happening. And that is often based on past experience, often early in your life, but maybe later, because terrible things happen to grown-ups too. Now, the point about nightmares is that they wake you before you have a chance to figure out how to survive. And basically, there was one theory about nightmares that they began way, way back in our early development as a contributor to our survival by replaying traumatic incidents so that we have a chance to figure out in the safety of our own dream life what you could do to save yourself if the same sort of thing happened again. And so the proper response to a nightmare, having, let's say, been wakened by it and been frightened, is when you have calmed down, probably the next day, that you sit down and think about it in terms of the story of the nightmare and figure out what you could do to help yourself survive. They're survival challenges. How are we going to do it? Sometimes it is because we have been through awful experiences which have historically happened, but the response that our minds have to traumatic events is to kind of repeat them and repeat them. They come again like aftershocks, like the aftershocks of an earthquake, for example. Your mind still has the aftershocks of that event. Now, what you can't change is the historical event that first happened. What you can change is the way it affects you afterwards.
And Matthew is named both apostle and evangelist. Does this make him even more special?
I don't think. I wouldn't put it that way. No. I'd say he's one of the unique characters, in a sense, of the first century, because he's writing from his own perspective, and that then makes him somewhat special. But I would think that he has a skill that compares with the skill of Luke, but they're really writing for different audiences. And therefore you can see what's happening in the early church as each of these individuals works with people and then proclaims the message and sort of defines the message for them. They have a different style and a different set of stories, a different set of expressions and creedal statements that they're going to rely upon. So that would be my response, really.
So St. Matthew, who was he? Is this the same St. Matthew, the tax collector, who was eager to meet Jesus and invite him into his house? Was it the same person, St. Matthew the evangelist?
this is the big question, of course, for biblical scholars. You know, the debates around Matthew have gone on for a number of years in the modern biblical critical world. So therefore, there is a sense whereby you'd say, well, perhaps if he's one of these Galilean personalities, that is from the north of the Holy Land, and he's a fisherman or a type like that, or comes from that sort of background, perhaps he wouldn't be quite as skilled as an author. And so you'd probably make a distinction about the apostle, strictly speaking, and then the evangelist. But I think in the tradition, we've added another title into the picture, and I would put three titles alongside his name: tax collector, apostle, and evangelist. And the way the church then remembers the person called Matthew is to play upon that threefold sense, if you like. And the idea is then that when we look back at the history books, as it were, we find very little information about a number of the early church members. And Matthew is a typical character from the early church that we know little of.
So you're the convener of this committee, and you're that is focusing on the protection of life, as you said, from its conception to natural death. Yet you're specialized on post-abortion counseling. This means counseling for women who have already had an abortion. Can you tell us more about your work as a counselor?
Well, very often, in fact, most times, the women who come are actually suicidal. And many of them would have spent years trying to figure out what's at the bottom of their heartache. But we have to understand that it's obviously we want to protect every single life. And that includes all of the human living people. And all of those women who have been wounded by abortions and their families, their extended families, their grandparents, their parents, the fathers, those people, they have a need to grieve. And society just doesn't allow them that space. And it's remarkable. I've seen women grieving a 5-week-old fetus just as if it was a 5-year-old child, you know. And they just need time. They need love, and they need time, and they need to know that it's important, that their grief is important and their child was important. And it's about bringing them to reconciliation, to forgive all those people who've hurt them, to bring them right through that grief stages. There's a lot of anger often, and bring them through to forgiving them, those other people, often the doctors and the medical staff, and then finally forgiving themselves. Because if they don't forgive themselves, they go through life still damaged and hurting.
How important do you think is spirituality in a person's life?
Well, it is widely important, but today the society is being missing this. I can't accuse the individual, any persons, because of the vast majority of the education system, media, and certain type of understanding, it's fluxing and pump up the secular lifestyle more important than to some other important things. So any individual under these circumstances, it's difficult to understand spirituality. But the spirituality, sometimes you don't need to be measured. Just a couple of minutes of the dark room or dark sky, you can feel it. It's screaming your inside. Today's society is big missing, and that's why the many young generations, they try to settle or stop it, the screaming through the usage of the substance or doing some nonsense. That spirituality, it's really screaming inside every individual that says, feed me, understand me, and communicate to me. But we don't know the language or communication or connectness of the spirituality of ourselves in a spectrum. We try to solve the problem at the world, and that's to create the more problem. Like the people are thirsty, need to be drink the water to satisfy, you know, the tenderness. We do more the, you know, the drinking, the salt water. I don't blame the society. The spiritual lifestyle is being screaming, defeat me, understand me, communicate me. Instead, we just ignore it and give it to more the materialistic type of lifestyle.
And the Imam was talking about the power of turning the enemy into a friend. He said it's a metaphor, it's an ideology, it's a belief system, an attitude and a behavior that every Muslim must possess, ability to turn the enemy into a friend. Say, by what? He said, the power of forgiveness. Identify someone who has hurt you dearly and extend the unconditional forgiveness. Don't expect him to come and say, I'm sorry. You don't need his I'm sorry. You don't need his apology. For you to be healthy, you need to let go, first and foremost. And to let go is to release that energy, that negative energy in you. When the Imam was talking this, I said, but Muhammad, I never hear this. He said, Muhammad did it in Makkah. Muhammad did it in Taif. Muhammad did it in Medina. He was giving different examples why the Prophet of Islam has done something similar that way. Because of that, I was crying that this is a new message I'm hearing, a message of love, of compassion.
After expressing forgiveness, after all that we have worked together, we started going around. First of all, we were supported by the British Council to go around Nigeria and set up Peace Institute between for young people. And we started dialogue. And then later, it now grew up to working with religious leaders. It wasn't easy because in those days, nobody wanted to see Christians and Muslims coming together. If they ever come together, it's to fight. And so we took the bull by the horn and started the initiative. I also had people who felt I was compromising my faith. They can invoke scriptures. Why do you unequally yoke together with unbelievers? And all those kind of terrible things. But I realized that the journey of my spirituality is embedded in what Jesus Christ will do. And Jesus has said, if we do promote peace, we are his children. And so we begin going around where we have asked people to hate and tell them love is the solution. And truly, at this point, as we are talking, there are proliferation of interfaith initiative in Nigeria. But when we started, nobody will do that dirty thing because you are putting your life online to even try to engage. You'll be disowned. An elder one time in the church asked that I should be investigated. Am I still a Christian? But Nigeria today, our initiative is respected. The Cardinal, John Cardinal Onaiko, of the Catholic, we have the Sultan, we have the President of Khan. All of them are in one kind of interfaith initiative for donor.
Realized that I was worried about a hospice family, and I thought, my goodness, how can I renew and refresh myself and serve others well, you know, if I'm constantly ruminating upon the suffering that I'm witnessing and expected to support and alleviate in some way. And I talked to a woman in my community who said to me, why don't you try mindfulness meditation? She worked with children who had been harmed, and she found that mindfulness assisted her to be present and to care for herself and others. So I did that, and that was the beginning of my mindfulness journey.
The word didike literally means the training. It's the Greek word for training. And we think of the early church as having things like the letters of Paul, and then later having documents like the Gospels. But quite apart from these, the letters of Paul were occasional things. They were occasioned by particular needs. And the Gospels are the written down recordings of gospelers who were coming to give a performance, an overview of the whole vision of Christian faith. But the people in the communities, in the local churches scattered all across the Mediterranean world, they needed something that would be their training. And the training began as something very simple, and it kept developing. And when it was still in the simple stage in the first and second centuries, it was something that every disciple of Jesus actually learned off by heart. Now, we knew that this existed because we had lots of references. They had learned the training, and they had read the training, and they had copied the training. And we knew, everyone said, well, what was it like? And people said, well, it probably included the Lord's Prayer. Yeah, well, so much. You don't have to be brilliant to make that guess. It probably included something like some sort of variant on the Ten Commandments. Well, again, you wouldn't have to be very bright to make that guess. But then, in 1873, a brilliant young Greek monk was working in a library in Constantinople, now Istanbul, cataloguing books. And the funny thing about this particular librarian was he had already spent a couple of years in Germany, and indeed he had there met all of the great editors. So as he was going through the book, his mind was alerted to be looking out for unusual things, and he discovered a copy of the Didache, a copy of the Didache that reflects the way the Didache was used in Greek around 80 AD. And this is the most precious document we have from the Christians from the first century that's not in the New Testament. And it's even more precious because all of the documents in the New Testament were special documents. This is the ordinary document. This gives us an insight into what was actually happening in a local church at the time. And so, for instance, it's got a very detailed list of do's and don'ts. And then we thought, well, that's very unusual. And then we found in 1947, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, we thought, aha, now we have a copy in Aramaic of the same thing that we find in a Christian document in Greek. And we realized that an awful lot of the moral practice that the Christians were putting forward to these Greek converts to the religion of Jesus, wasn't yet called Christianity, in the middle of the first century, they're actually using a document that was being used for training little Jewish boys and girls back in Palestine, which we had also lost. Human beings are almost incurably religious, even if they're not very obviously religious, or even if they say they're not religious. There is this somehow sense that there's something larger, there's mystery. And once you actually say there is mystery, you seek to address it. And it's that address that's prayer. Where Christian prayer comes in is that Jews and Christians and Muslims would say that they're is a dialogue between God and the individual, and between dialogue and the human family. And that dialogue takes the form of the invitation to pray. And so all three religions have had structures for prayer.
Based on culture and history of the times, if you look at it, there's a clear reason why women are marginalized in the Bible. And then if they are there, it's in spite of the fact that culturally and in historical context would leave them out. So you need to understand that when they are there, they couldn't get away with not mentioning them, because you wouldn't be able to understand the story without them in it. But in general, they weren't meant to be there, because the way the Bible, if you unpack it, is talking about things is very tribal. So in other words, Abraham represents a man, but he represents much more than a man. He was a community of people who were connected to his family. It was him, his wife, his kids, his father, his all of his servants, and the people who thought what he was saying was cool, and they all moved as an enclave. People didn't travel by themselves in the desert in the time, it was very unsafe to do that. So whenever you see individuals, they're actually representative of a group. So Abraham was a tribe, and his sons were each time a tribe, and all of Jacob's sons were tribes. And tribes were never named after a woman. They were named after men. It was a patriarchal society.
My generation, we lived in fear of the Cold War, of the nuclear bomb and all this. For a later generation, after 2001, September 11th, it was fear of terrorism. Today, it's climate change, which many of the 15, 16, 17-year-olds are extremely worried about. And yes, we try to listen to that in Teze and to try to understand what is God saying to us through these concerns.
Welcome Pope Francis to the periphery and made the point that Auckland is the largest Polynesian city in the world, and it would be a mecca for people from all the Pacific Islands if he were able to come. When we met with him personally, I was thinking, I don't think I can put that burden on him. I'll leave it to the department to let him know that he's been invited. I think when we raised the issue, they very politely rolled their eyes. I think they just put our name on the list.
Who knows? Who knows? Francis might have the idea, yes, let's go to the periphery.
Well, that's right. And we made that point. We know that he likes the peripheries.
You can't get further than New Zealand.
Yeah, we made that point. That's right.
I saw a real need for songs for primary school children which were accessible to them musically and lyrically, but they still had some theological depth to them. So when I was when I started teaching in the early 80s, a lot of the songs that in primary schools we sang were sort of, I call them the rainbow daffodil and butterfly songs, and they were cute and they were fun and they were good for religious education, but we kind of tried to squeeze them in to make them gathering songs or communion songs, and they weren't, So I thought, surely we can get music which is still attractive and accessible to children, but it actually matches what we're trying to do liturgically and theologically. So that's what started me off.
It's the Pietà by Michelangelo. What do we know about the creation of this masterpiece?
Indeed, thanks, Beate. It was originally commissioned by a French cardinal who was the papal ambassador, the French ambassador to Rome. And Rome at the time was the capital of the papal state. So it was commissioned by the cardinal for the French chapel in the old St. Peter's Basilica, the basilica built by Constantine in the 4th century for the cardinal's funeral piece. So it would have been an extraordinary work of art, unprecedented in its time in Rome, being a high Renaissance work of a Florentine sculptor in what was essentially an old medieval basilica, the first St. Peter's. So the Pope at the time was Rodrigo Borgia, Pope Alexander VI. So the French cardinal was commissioning it to a Florentine sculptor again for a piece in Rome. So it was a very important work for Michelangelo because he was young at the time when he got the commission. He was only 23 in 1498. He was now coming to Rome, to a city that he would not have been well known in, to do a work of art for a French ambassador.
I consider a song is just like a monologue. It just obviously has the heightened nature of music underneath. But you still need all of the storytelling skills and great connection to the audience when you're singing, as if you're acting. So for me, whether it is on any type of production, I'm always really you know, looking at the character and their journey. I would say I probably get my most satisfaction from the stage because I like being able to complete the full story in that one evening. Whereas when you're shooting a film or a television series, you're often doing things out of order. You know, you might be doing scenes from the last episode on your first day. So you really have to have a sense of where you've come from and where you're going to as a character. But I love the variety. I think in New Zealand you don't get pigeonholed, and that's really, really, really wonderful. So it means I've really had such a wide variety in my career, and long may that last. You know, older and bolder, trying things, that's mostly what I'm interested in, is new, exciting experiences.
Again, clarify the difference between ecumenism and interfaith.
Sure, sure. Well, ecumenism, which derives from a Greek word oikoumene, meaning the whole inhabited earth, or the sense of being together, and was a movement that began or emerged out of the late 19th century when initially Christian missionaries from different organizations and different churches began to ask the question, why are we competing with one another? In the missionary field, in terms of evangelical conversion, we're all trying to bring people to the same Lord, but we're doing it through different routes and it becomes confusing. Ecumenism came out of the context of trying to resolve issues, competitive praxis and so on, relating to a diversity of Christian denominational identities. So that's ecumenism, is actually, you might say, crossing borders and boundaries and evolving relationships within the diversity of one religious tradition. And although the term was coined within Christianity, you can, by analogy, apply it into other religious contexts as well. Whereas interreligious engagement, dialogue, or interfaith activities or whatever are across the main religious identities and religions themselves, however they may be expressed.
Son of David, son of Abraham. Now, I couldn't think of a better way of going into the New Testament than the genealogy that tells us all about in Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. So the whole thing is that the New Testament is hidden in the Old Testament. I mean, if we don't know the Old Testament, it's just a list of meaningless names, but they're there for a purpose. To establish the identity of Jesus. This, of course, is the most Jewish of the Gospel. And there are genealogies right through the Old Testament. Genesis 10 is a genealogy. The sort of the ancestry. We all carry the ancestry of others, of the past. And that establishes our identity now. If we want to know who Jesus is, we go to his own scriptures. And there's it's a list of names, sure, but it's got a purpose.
So, Brother Kieran, would you compare it to like a whakapapa?
Absolutely, because a whakapapa establishes the identity of someone today in terms of their past. And really, unless we appreciate the story of the Hebrew scriptures, then how can we appreciate the one who is the fulfillment of them?
Thank you. And just quickly, what is coming up at Titipona Mustari and Joy, the next session that we have is Elijah, Prophet of Fire, with myself, with Beate Matthies. The Prophet Elijah, his life, his miracles, and how he is bridging the narratives of the Old Testament with those of the New Testament. Monday, 24th of June, 2024, 7 to 8:30 p.m., it's a Kuha presentation. And I wish you all a wonderful Friday and kia kaha and keep safe.
Out there, oh, peace is calling in the bonds of love we make.